everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. It is really gorgeous out. The birds are singing. The sun is shining. My little baby plants are growing, and life is good. So I'm so happy to be here with all of you today. I have a great show planned. My guest today will be Margaret Gray. She is the author of a new book called Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. And I'll tell you more about her in a little bit. First, I want to just go over some things going on in and around the city and some issues that are, in the news that I want everyone to be aware of and do their part, signing petitions, calling your congressman, et cetera. First off, we've all been hearing about the drought in California. And, last week I think I talked about Nestle. They were in the news because they were taking a lot of the water out of the forest in California for their bottling operation, for their bottled water, even though their permit had expired something like 27 years ago. But they still were helping themselves to the water. But now I just read about Chevron selling back their oil-infused wastewater to farmers to water their crops. And I was like, no, this can't be real. Is this really possible? And sure enough, it is. This has been going on for a couple decades already. And, of course, the government expects Chevron to do the testing and, people expect that the government's doing the testing, and meanwhile, no one's really testing for what's in the water, since, the oil production now is very different than it was a couple of decades ago. And so it's a real problem. They are not testing the vegetables to see if they're toxic from all the oil wastewater. So keep your eyes open for that. Read more about it. I have a link to this article from the LA Times on my website, and I think it's really worth checking out because it's very, very disturbing. Some things I wrote about this week is, in Germany, more and more people are becoming vegetarians, even though they are known for their meat consumption and sausages. And I know I've gone to Germany for business, many times. And when I first went, probably like 15 years ago, it was almost impossible to even find vegetarian food. And now, I went this past year, and it was unbelievable. I had some of my best vegan meals in Berlin. It was just amazing. So it's really, really changed. You can really feel the change there. And they're doing it because of the environmental concerns and health concerns. And it's really a great trend, and I'd love more people here to be following that trend. In the news, they've been talking about income inequality really affecting the healthcare costs and or the outcomes, healthcare outcomes of people in this country, and where the U.S. is still one of the richest countries in the world, when it comes to healthcare, we have some of the worst outcomes, and it really has to do with the poor healthcare that people who don't have a lot of money get in this country. It's just horrendous. It's inexcusable, actually. I don't know what we can do about it. Obamacare, certainly tried to do something about it, and the Republicans are still trying to reverse that even to this day. So that's a problem. I also wrote about formaldehyde in our furniture and in our wood flooring. So many people are buying the new wood floorings that are veneers of wood glued together, and they're all put together with formaldehyde, and they have outgassing, and people don't really know about this. I know I bought a furniture set for outside, and it actually came with it. I didn't show this in the showroom, but when I got it and took it out, it had a sticker on it saying this furniture is illegal in California because of the formaldehyde and the chemicals in the furniture. So it's something we don't think about, but I've been told that formaldehyde is in our mattresses. We're sleeping, if we're lucky, 8 hours a day, 7 hours a day, on a mattress that has formaldehyde in it. So our environment is just being polluted on so many levels, and we're just not aware of it. So I just want to make everybody aware of it so that you know to look into things, to check things out, to question everything, because we don't have a government that is putting the people first. They put businesses first, corporations first, profit first. And our health and environment is really being affected. So we all have to do our part and think about that. I also every week, you know, put up some take actions that I like everybody to participate in. And this week I am asking everybody to give a call to Governor Cuomo, and if you're in New Jersey, Governor Christie, to veto the Port Ambrose liquefied natural gas port. This is a gas port that they want to put off the coast of Long Beach and New Jersey and Manhattan. And it not only will be a terrorist site or a potential site for terrorist action, but it also is just has so many poor ramifications, and it's actually in the same spot that they also want to put a wind farm. So if we're trying to decide between a liquid gas facility or a wind farm, I think it's really obvious which one I certainly would go for. And it's actually an event that I was going to tell you about later, but while I'm talking about the Port Ambrose liquefied gas facility, let me tell you about this event on May 16th called Hands Across the Sand. And this is going to be a peaceful, peaceful rally where everybody's going to line up on the beach in Long Beach and hold hands for 15 minutes. The event's going to take place between 11 and 1. So if you can join Hands Across the Sand in Long Beach on the boardwalk, that would be really, really great. Also, I was up in Albany last week, as I had mentioned, lobbying for GMO labeling, and that's something that we all have to keep the pressure on because we want GMO labeling. We also want, right now we fought hard to get country of origin food labels on our food, and of course they're trying to put in some legislation that's going to reverse that too. So we need to let President Obama know that we still want to keep the country of origin labels, but we also want GMO foods labeled. So lots of things to take action, and we need everybody to do that. Everybody's got to do their part. Couple great things going on around the Long Island, New York area. First off, there's a set of four different free vegetable gardening workshops taking place. The first one is this evening at the Mastec Marches Shirley Community Library. Then it's also going to be on May 9th at the Central ISIP Library, on May 26th at the Freeport Library, and May 27th at the Brentwood Public Library. And these are free vegetable gardening skills workshops. The presenters are two founders of Long Island Agricultural Network and Community Agricultural Network. And Larry and Heather are just, you know, such a great source of information, and they're giving these workshops for free so that we can all put some plants in the earth and grow some of our own food, which would be really a wonderful thing. May 8th, there's also a forum on challenges and solutions for renewables in New York City. That's going to take place at Rutgers Presbyterian Church. Suggested donation is $10, but you can also come in for free. It's really important to come if you are interested in this. It's being presented by United for Action Sustainability Task Force. So that should be a good event. May 9th, also Riverkeeper, the nonprofit organization responsible for helping to clean up the Hudson River. I mean, when I was a kid, you couldn't even go near the Hudson River. Now it's just so much better. But anyway, they're having a Riverkeeper sweep, which is an opportunity in over 90 different places along the Hudson River to help clean it up. So you can get onto their website and find out different locations and sign up for that. May 14th, there's going to be a karaoke party to benefit Mercy for Animals. You can go to their website and find out about that. It's going to be at Planet Rose from 6 to 9, $20 donation. Spring Planting Day at Catskee Farms. That's the farm that the Sylvia Center uses and also Great Performance uses for their catering. But it's a great farm upstate New York, and they're having a community planting day. So if you can come out for that, I know they'd appreciate that. May 19th, this is something I really want to talk to you about, and we'll talk to you about more when my guest comes on. This is a rally for farm workers and for equal rights taking place up in Albany. And farm workers traditionally are excluded from some basic rights like overtime pay, a day off, fair pay, things like that. And so this is a rally on May 19th up in Albany. There's buses, free buses, going from Long Island. You can find out more information about it on my website. And it's going to be a really great day, and all the farm workers out there could really use your support. So if you could find the time to get up to Albany on May 19th, either on the bus or driving, it would be a great day. And I'll tell you, when I went up to Albany last week, when you do that, you just feel like you're, you know, you are taking some of these issues into your hands and making a difference. And I really sat down with one of my assemblymen, Ed Ra, and I heard back from him saying we have his support to help co-sponsor the GMO labeling bill. So that's really great. So I feel empowered because I did that, and I'd like all of you to have that experience. And so this would be a great time to go. Wednesday, May 20th, is going to be the 5th annual sustainable food event taking place at Impact Hub. And this is going to be a panel discussion talking about different business opportunities and challenges in food technology and the good food movement. Afterwards, there's going to be a networking reception party. So doors open at 6:30 and starts at 6:45. You can find out more information on the Impact Hub website or on my website. And also coming up, June 5th through 7th, is going to be an edible business at Stony Brook, Southampton. This is going to be a whole day, actually a whole weekend workshop of speakers and food opportunities. So check out on the Edible Long Island website. You'll find out more information about that. It's an edible business at Stony Brook. And there's lots more things going on, but I'm going to just tell you, I don't want to take up more time. So just go to my website, see all the events. My website's iegreen.com. And you can find out a lot more about this. So I want to share a recipe for you now before I invite Margaret Gray on. I realized I still had some butternut squash hanging around from the garden, and I wanted to use those up before our spring is really upon us. Usually I think of butternut squash soup as more of a winter soup, but because I'm making it with coconut cream and, you know, it's really pretty light. It's not a heavy soup, so this is delicious. I had two small butternut squashes that I used up. If you have one large one, that's probably fine, too. So two butternut squashes. You need some garlic, some ginger, a tablespoon of minced garlic, three tablespoons of minced ginger, 2 teaspoons salt, 2 teaspoons cardamom, 3 teaspoons cumin, 2 teaspoons curry powder, 1/2 teaspoon cinnamon, 1 teaspoon turmeric, juice of 2 limes, 1 onion chopped, 4 carrots chopped, 2 potatoes cut into chunks, 1 can of coconut milk, 1/4 cup of maple syrup, and that's optional, and about 12 cups of water. And then you want parsley or cilantro as garnish and flavoring at the end. So you're going to start by cut the butternut squash in half. Remove the seeds and place it cut side down on an oiled roasting pan. And I put down parchment paper first and oil that and put the butternut squash right on top. And you're going to bake it at 375 for an hour until the squash is soft. So if you have small squashes, it might take less time than that. So just till you can really pierce it with a fork. Meanwhile, in a large stock pot, you're going to saute the onions and the carrots, the ginger and garlic in a little olive oil. And just enough to keep it sautéing and not sticking. If you need to put a little bit more in, you can. Add the spices and lightly toast those for about 2 minutes. And when the butternut squash is ready, you're going to scrape out the pulp, leaving the skin behind, and add the pulp to the stock pot. Then add enough water just to cover the squash by about 3 inches and bring that to a boil. Add the potatoes and let the whole pot simmer for about 30 minutes. You can remove it from the heat, and with an immersion stick or blender, you're going to puree the soup until it's completely smooth. Return to the stove and add the coconut milk and the lime juice. And if the soup seems too thick, you can add some more water. Taste it. You can add the maple syrup, up to 1/4 cup of maple syrup. But you can start with just a tablespoon and see how it is. And adjust the spices to taste. You can put a little bit more cinnamon or a little bit more spice, depending on what you like. And then garnish it with the fresh parsley or the cilantro. And that's it. It really comes together quick. I mean, the butternut squash takes a little while to roast in the oven, but you know, no labor involved. Just stick it in there. So it really comes together very quick, and it's really delicious. So enjoy that. Of course, I love feedback, so if you do make the soup, let me know how it is for you. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Margaret Gray. As I said before, she came out with a new book, Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. Margaret is also an associate professor of political science at Adelphi University. And her book, and one of the things that she's focused her study on, is farm workers and food politics. And her book has won the Best Book Award from the Association for the Study of Food and Society, and also the Best Book Award from the Labor Project of the American Political Science Association. She received her PhD from CUNY Graduate Center and was a postdoctoral Rockefeller Fellow at Stony Brook University's Latin America and Caribbean Studies Center. And her focus is on low-wage, non-citizen workers in the agri-food business and their civic, cultural, and economic opportunities. And this just goes hand-in-hand with that rally I was telling you about up in Albany. So I'm going to just invite Margaret on and let her tell you more about the great work she's doing. Margaret, are you there?
I am. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Thank you. And let me just ask you, do you prefer to be called Margaret or Maggie?
You can call me Maggie.
Maggie, okay. So talk to us first, you know, what inspired you to write the book? And what is the what do you see as the appeal for people with local food?
Sure. So I was really inspired because I had been studying human rights and Latin American politics in graduate school when I bought a house in the Hudson Valley and, you know, loved living in the Hudson Valley and being able to buy from local farms, and then suddenly realizing how many farm workers I was seeing in the fields but not really seeing anywhere else. So that was what motivated me really to tell their story, and it, you know, it very much fit perfectly with the direction that my studies were going in already. And I think why this book will be very interesting for people interested in food and local food is because I think that we're living in this incredible moment where food has been a vehicle for educating us. And we've seen food used to educate us about preserving the land, making sure smaller farmers have sustainable livelihoods, a real focus on environmental concerns, and of course the treatment of animals. I think also we've just gotten such a good education through all this food writing that's blossomed in the last decade, just about how food is grown. And I think when I, you know, where I think my work comes in is that the workers on these farms, they've really been orphaned by the food movement. And what I saw happening was whenever conversations about labor came up, it was always about the poor labor conditions on corporate industrial factory farms, and there really wasn't any conversation about what was happening on local farms and smaller farms. And when so much praise was heaped upon these smaller producers, and I think for very good reason, I think it's very easy for the public and for consumers to assume that everything is better on these local and smaller farms. And that's just not what I found in terms of labor conditions.
Really? So you found the same conditions across the board on all small family farms, even organic family farms?
So, of course, I cannot say I looked at all family farms, but the farms I looked at in the Hudson Valley, and I interviewed about 150 farm workers in the Hudson Valley between 2002 and then again in 2008 and 2009, and there were definitely general trends about how these workers were treated.
Now, 100 workers dispersed by how many farms? Like about how many farms is that?
Yes, so I looked at 19 farms in the Hudson Valley.
19 farms.
Yes, yes. And, you know, what I found very much resonated with the existing research on farm workers that was done in other places in the country. So, but your question was about the organic farms. I didn't particularly target organic farms at all.
Uh-huh.
And I'm anecdotally, I know that I've met organic farmers who are pretty small and rely on, I don't know, sort of college-age young people,
right,
or woofers, and these types. But that's not at all the general trend in agriculture in the Hudson Valley or in New York State.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So when you say these are small family farms, how small are they?
Yeah, so I think these are very complicated terms. Family farm only means ownership structure if it's owned by and managed by a family. So 98% of the farms in New York State and upwards of 95% of the farms in the country are family farms. So you might as well just say farm. Family farm doesn't really mean that much, even though it's a term that resonates with us. And then small is also tough because if you look at it by acreage, you could have a 200-acre apple orchard, which is a pretty big apple orchard, but that might not be a lot for another size farm. I mean, certainly when you compare farms in New York and the Hudson Valley to places like Florida, Texas, California, the farms we have here are much smaller. They're, you know, mm-hmm. average size around 200 acres. But in terms of the workforce, I think on one farm I found 80 workers and on another 50 workers, but it ranged from 2 to 10 to 19 workers. So many of these farms had a pretty small workforce.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of conditions did you find that they were living in?
So the main issues that I were looking at, that I was looking at, wasn't to look for any sort of abuses that were taking place, but rather what were the common issues, what were the structural conditions. So what I found was that workers were toiling pretty long hours, and they didn't get any overtime pay. There's no right to overtime pay for agricultural workers. And so workers commented to me about this and said things like, when we feel like second-class citizens, when the law doesn't protect us. And they felt that it was sending a message to the industry that farm workers weren't as important as other workers, and that this was something that they feared would then lead to them being mistreated. So workers also, some of them had issues with housing. Some of them had issues with being respected by their employers. But one of the most interesting findings I came across was that there's a level of paternalism on these farms that you don't find on the much larger corporate farms. Paternalism really means when the employer is in charge of some aspect of your life outside of just the work relationship. So if you're housed on a farm, that's pretty much the definition of a paternalistic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found was that workers were getting benefits that were outside of just the labor contract. So they might be able to take food from the farm, and they might be able to use farm vehicles or have family members live on the farm. And these are, you know, these many people consider really great perks for the job, and even the workers themselves consider these great perks. But what I found is that because these perks aren't guaranteed, workers tend not to complain in order to make sure they keep getting those perks.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, on one farm, I remember asking workers, you know, well, what would you do in a situation where you weren't paid for 2 weeks? And they looked at me and they said, well, we're not really sure what we would do because the farmer's really nice to us, right? So this paternalism is very double-edged because on the one hand, workers can feel very protected and that they're getting benefits, but on the other hand, this paternalism acts as a form of labor control to keep workers from complaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like, you know, it's tough, though, because, you know, from farmers, and again, when I talk about family farmers or small farmers, I'm talking about more ones that I know on Long Island who are organic farmers, and they're really small, and like you said, they have college kids and woofers and, you know, but some do, you know, hire, Mexican workers and, Central American workers. And you're right, you know, I get the feeling that they're, you know, treated nicely and they're, you know, they're given housing and they're given food, and so they don't have to pay for those other expenses that in this area on Long Island would be a fortune. They wouldn't be able to afford to live there. So, you know, and the farmers don't have a lot of money. So, you know, it's a, yet they do have the space and they do have the food. So it's kind of like somewhat of a barter system. And sometimes I think that that could work in everyone's benefit. You don't? I mean,
yes.
Sometimes I think, you know, the you know, bartering and not, you know, and doing things by, you know, just, you know, by caring for each other, sometimes that does feel better to me. You didn't see it that way, huh?
Well, no, I agree with you that that's an ideal situation. I think when you barter, though, I think that there's an implication that when people are bartering, they're coming to the table in a sort of equal position, right? Oh, I have this to offer, and I have this to offer, and that there's a exchange taking place. But there's a pretty extraordinary power difference between the typical farm worker in New York State and the farmer. So let me tell you a little bit about the workers. I found they had a sixth grade average education in their home country. Many of them could not read or write. Most of them could not speak English or read English. Many of them felt that there was a racial dynamic taking place, so that because they weren't white, they were less powerful. And then, of course, the main issue is that they're not citizens. And so being someone who's undocumented or a guest worker means that you're essentially living in a real climate of fear. And it's not that you're necessarily concerned that your boss is going to call immigration, but that you might be doing your food shopping, or you might be riding your bicycle, or you might go through a stop sign, and then the implications are, and those are all situations I've heard about that have then led to being captured by immigration and being deported. So again, I think, yeah, I think a bartering system is lovely, but I think that that's very far from what's happening on farms when you have a pretty serious power differential. And I also think, to talk about bartering really removes the fact that these are employees, right? I mean, it's not like this is a neighbor coming in to say, let me pick your carrots and next week you can help me repair the roof on my house. So when you have an employer-employee relationship, that's, you know, right away there's a power situation there that's very far from a bartering situation.
Right, right. Yeah, I guess I'm just talking about, you know, they are getting paid, but then the benefits, if you put a monetary value on those benefits that they're getting of the some of the extra things, it would just seem like it makes the job better paid. You know, like if you had to figure a monetary amount for the housing or for the food or for having your family in there, like you were saying, you know.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough thing because, you know, I know we're all talking about, you know, raising minimum wage so that people who are working can live a decent life. And, you know, and that's across the board for immigrant workers and American citizens, you know, who live here and, you know, need to be able to support themselves. So anyway, I'm just saying, you know, if a farmer truly can. And yet, I know that there's, you know, some farmers that probably would, if you're saying 95% of U.S. farms are family-owned, and yet you know they're being subsidized, and, you know, they're not the small family farms that we think of when we think of family farms. I had no idea 95% of U.S. farms would be called family farms.
Yeah, it's just about ownership structure. It doesn't have anything to do with size or profit.
Right.
But I, you know, you brought up some really interesting points, and I think one of them is that a lot of farmers, and these fruit and vegetable farmers, they're not receiving subsidies from the federal government the way the larger grain producers are. But so many of these farmers, and I've talked to them, you know, they feel really compromised in terms of their own ability to make a profit. We've got a food system here where the food is just so cheap that even mm-hmm. when you're selling through local channels, it's not like you can charge that much more money. And in so many ways, I think these smaller producers and the farm workers are really on the same side of the table with the corporate industrial system on the other side. When you mm-hmm. have, you know, when you have five grocery store chains that dominate U.S. Food sales, those grocery stores get to figure out what the prices are. And we have the cheapest food in all westernized countries. And so certainly, yes, I think farmers' ability to pay a better wage can be really challenged. And so I think farmers can feel good about the fact that they're giving these sort of perks and benefits to workers.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think we just have to realize that you can't separate that. You can't separate that from the fact that it turns into a form of labor control because it's not mm-hmm. guaranteed, right? So as soon as something's not guaranteed, the workers feel like I have to be a good worker in order to get those benefits. And, you know, I mean, I'm thinking
about... Is that a bad thing? I mean, they should be a good worker.
Well, I think it's a bad thing. I think it's a bad thing when, you know, you have hours missing from your paycheck and you're afraid to say something about it.
Right, right.
When you feel like you should be able to take a break and you can't take a break because you have to work too much. When you know you have to be out in the fields at 6 in the morning and you're not going to get home until 11 o'clock at night. So some workers told me that even requesting an extra day off, you know, they said, well, you'd probably get it, but the boss wouldn't be happy about giving it to you. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, when I say being a good worker, what workers talk about is not complaining, right? So a good worker in their mind is someone who just doesn't complain about anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've spoken to workers who've injured themselves. You know, you have really sharp implements in farm work. I've spoken to workers who've cut themselves really badly and then just end up wrapping it up and keep working.
Right.
And I think that's a problem, right? I think that you should, in that sort of situation, you should feel confident enough that you could go to your employer and say, I need to go to the emergency room. And I know plenty of situations, too, where workers have gone to employers and the employers refuse to take them to the emergency room
or
won't give them any help with medical bills, right? And mm-hmm. and this is, I'm not saying that is common, but I've heard of these situations. And so what workers feel is that since the law marginalizes them, since they're not citizens, that all these factors make it really easy for them to be exploited.
Sure, sure. It's a really tough situation. No, I've had a guest on my show. I don't know if you know Sarah Jayaraman. She wrote the book Behind the Kitchen Door.
Yes,
and it's
great
a little
book.
Bit of a similar thing, you know. And it's still with the good food movement. You know, I mean, she was talking about, you know, the restaurants that are sustainable type restaurants, and you know, and everybody's there feeling good that they're eating the local food, and they're you know, supporting the local farmers and that the chef is doing the right thing and feeling good about their meal. And yet right behind the kitchen door, you have similar situations, undocumented workers, people working overtime, people not getting for their full pay. And, you know, and she, you know, started bringing that issue more to the forefront and making people aware, you know, from the restaurant side of it.
Yes.
And I think they're very much the same issues. Both communities are really in unfortunately the perfect position to be exploited, and and do need to get some protection.
Yeah, and that's a great book. And I think an aspect of both what happens when in those restaurants and also on these farms is that it's so easy for us to fall into a real romance with smaller providers, with local food, when so much of it is pushed on us or presented to us in a way that we're doing the right thing when we buy local food, that this is the more ethical choice to be making on how we're going to spend our money on food. And so I think one aspect of it is that there's this pretty significant layer of romance that it's difficult to challenge that romance. So in a regular industry where there's not a particular romance, it's difficult to raise issues about workers' concerns. But when you have a situation where the public is so sympathetic to the bosses, right, to the farmers, it becomes even so much more difficult for workers to be able to get their stories out there. And, I mean, I think that's part of the problem, too, is that there's just such a dearth of media on the farm workers, particularly when you consider how much attention the food industry is getting, how much attention goes to farmers. You know, on Long Island, it's hard to pick up a publication between May and November and not see profiles of local producers.
Right. Well, that's why it's so great that there are people like you doing that work and, you know, and helping to raise that awareness, because it is very important that we all think about these things and, you know, and look at them and address them and ask the right questions. But actually, before we go any further, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, we'll really dive into this a little bit more, okay?
Okay.
Everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Maggie Gray, author of Labor and the Locavore. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest today is Maggie Gray, Associate Professor of Political Science at Adelphi University, and author of this great new book called Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. Maggie, you with me?
I'm here.
Great. So, so we're talking about farm workers and the disparity between you know, their work and farmers in the Hudson Valley. Do you see, when you were looking at the farm workers in the Hudson Valley, did you also look at how is it any different in other areas of the country? Like, would the East End farmers on Long Island have similar situations?
Yeah, so my in-depth research was really on the Hudson Valley, but I can tell you anecdotally from workers I've met out on Long Island and in Western New York and up in the Northern New York that they're very similar situations. So even the, you know, I was talking about this paternalism that takes place, and I know some folks who were recently out on a farm on Long Island, and they were talking to the workers, and the workers were saying how great the boss was, that every morning they get coffee and they get a piece of bread. And as the conversation progressed, there was some talk about how long their day was. And they said they pretty much worked until the sun went down. And they were asked, you know, how much time they got for a lunch break. And they said they didn't get any lunch break. They, you know, they tried to eat while they were working. Sometimes they could, sometimes they couldn't. And then they were asked, well, how many breaks do you get during the day? And they said that they didn't get any breaks.
Wow. Uh-huh.
And the person I was talking to said, can you help me understand this? You know, they think this boss is great, but they're working, you know, 11, 12 hours a day straight without any breaks at all. And I think that's something to keep in mind is that for so many of these workers, they can make in a day what they might make in a week back home. Right?
Or a month. You know, or a month.
Well, probably not a month, but jobs are really tough to come by. So these are workers who are willing to sacrifice. They're willing to put up with labor conditions that most of us would find unacceptable. And I think that that's one of the issues we also need to really keep in mind. You know, the face of the farm worker really isn't the woofer. It really isn't the recent college grad who's thinking about starting her own farm at some point. The vast majority of workers in the state and in the country on farms are non-citizen Latino workers. And so they you know, they really come with a vulnerability that makes it very challenging for them. So yes, I have been speaking with folks who talk with farm workers out on Long Island, and even when the workers say, "Oh, my situation's okay," when they're then asked a series of questions, you know, they might not be making the proper minimum wage. They might not be getting any breaks during the day. So I think that, you know, that's something that can be tough for us to imagine when we're buying local food, that might be the labor situation on the farm.
Uh-huh. Yeah, really hard, really hard. You know, it's like as a chef, and, you know, I've done lots of catering in my day, and I know certain types of jobs are such, you know, you wish you could spread all the hours evenly over a week of 8 hours each day. But the reality is when I'm catering, you know, I'm working 18 hours the day before, and, you know, and the day of, I'm working straight through and, you know, and taking almost no breaks either, because you're, you know, my waiters and waitresses too. I mean, you know, they'll come back and put something in their mouth, but there's not really break time because the affair is going on for, you know, the solid 8 hours. You know, you're setting up, doing the affair and cleaning up. And so sometimes the nature of work, and I would guess, you know, farm working is like that too, in that, I mean, certainly you can take breaks in farm working because, you know, what you're picking is not going anywhere. But, you know, sometimes, you know, certain jobs just require, you know, morning to night, like you said, you know, when it's in season and farm workers have to pick, you know, they need picking to be done in the daylight hours. So, but certainly everyone should be entitled to some breaks and to taking lunch and things like that. Where do you see the plight lies with the farmer or the greater public? How do you see this getting better? I mean, I know I mentioned going up to Albany to bring awareness to the problem.
Yes. So, I mean, I think one way to look at it is there a fight? I think another way to look at it is, are we building a sustainable food system? So right now there are very few opportunities to know what the labor conditions are on the farms where we buy our produce, unlike, you know, organic certification or standards in regard to animals that we can more easily find out about farms. So I think one way to really think about it is the farmers who are offering a sustainable livelihood, who aren't requiring really excessive hours, who are giving the breaks. You know, if I think those farmers should be really held up. I think those are the farmers we should buy from, but the problem is trying to identify them.
I would think also if you bring too much attention to it, many of them are hiring, like you said, undocumented workers, which is not legal either.
Right, and then that's another reason why this issue really gets, you know, swept under the rug a little bit, because
they
want to talk about it. They feel very threatened by the idea that someone might be asking questions about their workers. I mean, they, you know, even if you think about it in terms of the way animals are treated versus the way workers are treated, farmers are often ready to give you a whole list of the way that the animals are treated on the daily basis, you know, what kind of hours, what kind of shade, what kind of climate, what are the housing conditions, how much open space. But it can be very threatening for a farmer when you start asking questions about workers for that very reason. And I think it brings up the point, to go back to what you were saying, you know, farmers often feel they don't have a lot of options except to hire non-citizen workers, because most people wouldn't accept the wages and the conditions and the amount of labor that goes along with farm work. I mean, even, you know, you were talking about the catering. Those people who are waitressing and, you know, working in the kitchen with you, most of them would not tolerate the conditions they would have in farm work. And I think you're right. There are plenty of industries where it feels like you just have to put in these hours. Mm-hmm. And I And if it were, if this were true just, you know, during the harvest, right, 2 or 3 weeks during the harvest or something where really extensive hours were required, but so many farms are diversified, and, you know, I know workers who for months work 80 to 90-hour work weeks, months at a time, right? So mm-hmm. they don't have the same option you do in terms of I'm going to pick this catering job or not pick this catering job. So
right.
I think the fact is so many of these workers feel that they have no other option because there are very few jobs where you don't need the language skills, where you can, you know, pick up the job pretty quickly while you're there. I mean, these are very skilled positions, but you can learn the skills on the job. It's not, you don't necessarily have to come with a particular skill set.
And like you said, the majority of them only have up to a 6th grade education.
Yes, the ones I
right.
interviewed. Yeah. Uh-huh. So,
right.
you know, I think...
So, you know, if you think of an American who, you know, drops out of school at 6th grade, they're not going to get much workability either. You know, they're not going to be qualified for much more than farm working. You know, working in the restaurant.
Sure. And we still have high school dropouts today, but, you know, it's not that we have large elements of the workforce who are in that same situation. And luckily, we have free public education here where people can go get their high school equivalency, and we have all sorts of job training programs through the Department of Labor. But I think, you know, to go back to this question of where does the fight lie, I think the fight lies in, as consumers, as people who are really interested in the food we buy, what does sustainable mean to us? You know, is it sustainable when it's organic and the animals are treated well, but you've got workers putting in 80 hours a week and just making minimum wage? You know, I think it's really a question for us to try to imagine what sort of food system do we want. And we've told farmers in the past that we're willing to pay more if the food is organic, we're willing to pay more if the animals are treated a certain way, we're willing to pay more just to support a local farmer. So I think it's really about trying to figure out how can we extend that to include workers as well. And I think this is a very significant challenge. It's a very significant challenge.
Well, I remember when there was the big awareness around the farmers in Florida, the tomato pickers, the milky workers. You know, they... You know, I think it was only going to cost another 1 or 2 cents a pound to the grocers to pay the workers a decent wage. I mean, that's nothing.
Yeah, that's made a significant difference. And there's an agricultural economist named Philip Martin out at UC Davis, and he estimates that to really improve farm workers' livelihoods, it would probably cost us about $15 a year increase in our fruit and vegetable purchases. But I think what we have to keep in mind is that that's really about a corporate industrial system, right? So those workers picking tomatoes, that's the only thing they pick all day, and those are sold to large corporations who then have been able to put this pressure on the farmers to improve conditions and sign a code of conduct. And there's been significant changes in Florida tomato farms because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it might cost a little bit more than a penny per pound. But the question is, when you raise food prices, it can be tough to pass that on to workers in terms of a wage increase. Because for farmers, the cost of equipment goes up every year. The cost of gas goes up every year. The cost of their seeds, the cost of fertilizer, the cost of any sort of pest control they use. And so when you have all these costs that you consider hard costs, that you can't really do anything about those costs, it can be easy to try to say, well, I don't have to give my workers a raise because the law says this is only what I have to pay, and I can try to get my workers to work faster. So it's very challenging if you're a struggling business person, which most of these small farmers in New York are. They are really struggling. So how do you come up with a system where the benefits can be sent directly to workers? It's a challenge.
Mm-hmm. So as consumers, is there a way for them to know whether their fruits and vegetables are coming from local farms that embrace and promote fair labor?
So there's something called the Agricultural Justice Project, which is a certification, but it only has a handful of farms involved right now. I think it's really tough. I think until you have a change in the law, so you know that workers are getting paid overtime, it's going to be tough to tell, because I've certainly met farmers who feel like, listen, 60 hours a week is enough for my workers. But as I mentioned, I've met other workers who put in 80, 90 hours a week on a regular basis. So it's tough. And I think sometimes when you talk to the employer and then you talk to the worker, you might get very different perspectives about what's happening on the farm. So as of right now, you know, you can talk to the farmer, but we already discussed that this is, I think as soon as you start asking questions about workers, it's challenging for the farmers. But I do think that as consumers, this is someplace we can start. And I think the food movement has done a brilliant job at training consumers to ask questions about pesticide usage, to ask questions about the way animals are treated. And it would be amazing if the food movement, and I know there are many food movements, but if more folks took on the issues of workers and said, why don't you start these conversations with your farmers right now, you know, and to try to even let farmers know that we care about workers. Because in my experience, when I ask farmers, how many people ask you about pesticide practices, you know, they almost roll their eyes. Everybody asks them about this. And I say, who asks about labor conditions or your workers? Nobody. Nobody asks these questions. So I think even if we just started asking questions, where are your workers from? How many workers do you have? Even just what might be considered some softball questions. And I think it's really important also to get a sense from farmers about how they feel that paying overtime would affect them. Or are they only paying the minimum wage right now? Or are they paying more for that? So I think that...
So paying the same amount for the whole 80 hours versus paying, you know, time and a half for the second 40 hours.
Right, right.
Uh-huh.
So I think one aspect of what we can do is really start to get into conversation with farmers. I mean, I know that I'm part of conversations with some farmers about, you know, how can we change this? How can we do something? And the conversation, the farmers I'm in conversation with, they want to be talking about this. They want to figure out how to improve conditions, and they want to figure out how to hold themselves up as not asking for 90 hours a week and not feeling like they're being very exploitative of their workers. So,
and also for them to not be in fear that, I mean, those are the only people they can get to work out in the farm, and yet they're breaking the law if they're hiring the illegal people. So there has to be some sort of immigration reform as well, as we've all been talking about, so that these workers who are doing a job that nobody else wants to do can be here legally, and so that a farmer doesn't feel like they're breaking the law just by even having them, so, because that makes the conversation, as you were saying, so much more difficult.
Yeah, yeah. But I think also the average person can say, I'm not asking you if your workers are legal or not. I'm just concerned about these other questions. Because I don't think the average consumer is going to be reporting somebody for having an undocumented workforce. But yes, this is very much a reality, and farmers struggle with it all the time. Farmers are in constant fear that their workers will be deported. So, I mean, I think again, something else is that there are so many shared concerns that farmers and their workers have. I think what I'm seeing is that there are power dynamics on the farm that a lot of farmers may not even be aware of. They may not even be aware that their workers are afraid to complain about something. And so starting to shift conversations about workers being important, trying to shift conversations about how farmers might try to reach out to their workers more, these are all going to help move forward a more sustainable local food system.
Right. Well, we're just about out of time, so could you just tell everybody the name of your book again and where they can find it?
Yes, it's called Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. It's published by University of California Press. You can check out the website, laborandthelocavore.org. You can find it on Amazon, and you can certainly request it at your local bookstore.
Great. And will you be going up to Albany? Are you able to get off that day?
Yes, I think I will go up there so that I can speak to workers and the advocates up there, definitely.
Good. Well, maybe we'll go together. Everybody out there, thank you for joining us. We're just about out of time. Maggie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And have a great rest of the week, everyone. And when you shop at your farmer's market, do ask. See what the labor conditions are. And let's start these conversations. Everyone, have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.